Thank you so much for tuning into this mini season of New World of Work. I've had the pleasure of exploring the future of remote and distributed work with two amazing guests so far. And the final episode of our mini series, I welcomed not one, but two very special guests, Anna Maria Dorgo and Sophie August, co-hosts of the Mapping Ties podcast and expert internal community builders. If you're interested in how to build belonging and connection in the workplace and how to empower employees in this work, you're in for a real treat in this episode. Internal community building at remote and distributed workforces is crucial to employee connection. It keeps people engaged with their work and gives employees an opportunity to be known and understood. While distributed workforces have countless pros, some would consider it a con that cultivating community internally has to be even more intentional. It can be hard. Ultimately, it falls to people leaders to ensure that employees feel like they are a part of meaningful communities, no matter where in the world they're located. But the greatest people leaders know it doesn't rest solely on their shoulders. They have a community of employees who are typically already natural-born connectors, building community in grassroots ways across the company. At Oyster, I help build and grow our internal community. And here are some of the lessons I've learned so far. Give other people the opportunity to form their own communities. I can't be everything to everyone, and no one expects me to be, but I can give them the tools they need to host their own community moments. When people are given the room to express their interests and invite others in, such as a book club or a Slack channel dedicated to memes, you're actually giving community enough space to grow on its own. They don't need me for this. Make sure your internal communities are easy to find. For example, if your company uses Slack, consider creating a living directory of community channels, or select a short list of community-centric channels to be set as default for new employees as they join the company. That way they can dive in immediately and they can still manage their own membership by coming and going in the channel as they please. Have rituals and routines. This is something I'm excited to explore more this year at Oyster because in my career, I've learned that community members really appreciate predictability. Remember when we all worked in offices 5 days a week and we had our ritual of going to the break room for coffee or stopping by that team member's desk at a certain time every afternoon for a break? Remote workplaces need that too. And having rituals folks can depend on to easily contribute to makes it easier and more natural for them to decide to engage other times. Now, let's dive into this episode. Great. So wonderful to have you both here today. I would love if each of you introduce yourself, state your name, and share a little bit about your career experience so far. So, Sophie, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having us as well. I'm really excited about having this three-part conversation. So I'm Sophie August, and I'm a learning community leader at Beck Hughes. It's an energy technology company, and our team, so the corporate talent and learning team, we create and we design three learning communities that focus on leadership and transformation skills for our business. So we have a community for all employees, a community for people leader, and then another one for senior executives. And I've actually been in community building and in the people and culture space only for less than 2 years now. And before this, I used to work in procurement. So I was managing subsystems contracts on hundreds of millions of dollars offshore projects, a completely different world. And so I guess my career has really been community building was more of a way of doing things and doing like a role that was completely different. But I was the one organizing series of lunch and learns for us all to learn from other teams or volunteering initiatives, etc. And then it evolved and turned into my full-time role. So that would be like really the thread in my career. And I also still have some of these grassroots communities. So there's still one that is really dear to my heart. It's called the Parenting Tribe that we created with ex-colleagues from the procurement time. And it's a support network for working parents. And so this one is a completely grassroots community independent from my learning role. So I still have these two kind of practices of a curated corporate community and one that is fully independent and very grassroots. And I guess my third big community project is Mapping Ties as well. So it'd be hard to mention now my career and profession without Mapping Ties. And Mapping Ties is really where I learn and discover everything about how other people, other companies do internal community building. So it's the lab, it's the playground, and it's the classroom and all together. And it's been a really cool collaboration project with Ana Maria.
Yes, I can't wait for our listeners to hear more about Mapping Ties specifically, because it's going to be another great place for them to learn. And Sophie, real quick, tell us where you're based.
Oh, yes. I'm based in Norway currently. So in the southwest of Norway, it's like fjord country for people who don't know Norway. We actually work remotely. So our team is based in South America, in the States and Asia. So I work from home.
Great. Yeah. A big piece of this conversation is not just internal communities, but the globally distributed aspect of it. Ana Maria, tell us who you are, where you're based, and yeah, what do you do?
Yes. Hi, Katie. I am based in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. I'm originally from Romania, born and raised there. I am what you, I guess, would call a people person or people person. My background is psychology. I studied psychology. I have a master in HR. I worked in HR as an HR business partner for many years in retail before pivoting to learning and development. That was over 5 years ago, probably almost 6 years ago. And that in my role as an L&D manager is where kind of my journey or contact or exploration of communities has started on a practical level. Fun fact, I wrote my master dissertation of communities of practice in academia. Not a lot of people know that.
Wow.
So we go way back. And yeah, I in my role as an L&D business partner for Accentate, a Dutch eyewear brand, I built a small community of practice internally for Train the Trainers, a Train the Trainer program that we had. And then I also started outside of work what is today L&D Shakers, a global community of practice for learning and development professionals. And that was kind of my, I don't know, trampoline, my starting point into this world. And I was like, what is this place? Why do I love it so much? Why am I learning so much? And who are all these cool people that are coming together to do cool stuff? Why isn't school more like that? Why wasn't university more like that? And also, why isn't learning within companies more like that? And my work through L&D Shakers, I could say, put me on the radar on the team at Butter, where I work now part-time as a head of community. I joined the team 2 years and a half ago. I built their community from scratch. It's a hybrid community, both for users, but everyone else externally that is looking to improve their facilitation skills. So again, a community of practice for facilitators. And I also am running my own business called Handle With Brain. So I kind of have my feet in three different buckets: Handle With Brain, my business; Butter, my part-time job; L&D Shakers, my passion project and baby. And I've met Sophie last year. She attended my Building Community From Within No course. We had a really great connection and we stayed in touch. And I think in one of our conversations, we just talked then, was like, where are you learning about communities of practice internally? Like, who's doing this? What are companies are doing it? What are best practices out there? And we couldn't answer that question because all of the podcasts, all of the events, all of the experts, all of the courses were mainly oriented towards external facing communities, like communities for users or clients. And we said, this is it. It's a gap in the market that Mapping Ties is going to fill. And it wasn't meant to be a podcast. Today, it's a podcast, or it continues to live on as a podcast where we surface stories from practice of internal community builders. It started as a 7-part LinkedIn audio event, but we had so much fun, both Sophie and I, and we were learning so much as well as our guests, but also the audience. It resonated a lot and was like, this has to continue to live on. So stay tuned for the second season of Mapping Ties coming out soon.
So much inside of what you said I relate to. Like I found you both because I was on LinkedIn shouting into the abyss of who else is doing internal community building? What titles do you all have? You know, we just sort of have to like send out the bat signal to find each other. I want to hear more about mapping ties. So first, you talked a little bit about it. What is it? Do you describe it as a podcast? It feels like it's more than that. So what is Mapping Ties? And you talked a little bit about what inspired it. But if someone is not familiar with Mapping Ties, what is it and who is it for?
I can take that one. So I think, yes, it's definitely more than a podcast. And so far, it's been audio events. It's been a live workshop. And now the audio events are published as a podcast. But there's been a lot more interaction than this. And the audience would be really for community builders, for people who are interested in internal community building, for people who tend to connect people at work naturally or who do it as part of their job. So it's quite a wide variety of people who would learn and benefit from listening to it. I think as long as you're curious and interested and you're looking for best practices into this field of bringing people together, created belonging, togetherness at work, because it's definitely a podcast that is very focused on the practice.
That is so powerfully useful. Like that's such a useful resource because many times people who are doing this work, they're the only person at the company doing this work, or maybe they're reporting to a leader who, best case scenario, believes in it, but hasn't done that work themselves. And so there's a little bit of educating your direct manager. And so having a resource like that, learning from people who have done this work and can point to a case study of here's what we did, here's how we measured. If you feel like you're on an island in your own company doing this work, Mapping Ties is a great resource to try new things. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. Other people are doing it and you can find them.
Love it's definitely that. Provided that feeling, at least for me. And yes. Maya, I don't know if you wanted to add anything else to Mapping Ties.
I think you captured the essence very well, but also is, I think we started this project, you and me, Sophie, back in, I think it was October, and we didn't have big expectations. It was like, let's just do 10 events. And let's just find 10. And in the end, I think we found 10 people and we hosted 7 events. Let's just find 10 people that can talk about this and are doing this in companies. Okay, let's just host these 7 events and then we'll see. And then it's like, okay, let's just continue with the podcast. And it's like, let's just get together with some of our guests and talk about our work. And now we're just riding this energy wave and we're at the stage where Mapping Ties can become anything, actually, if we feel the excitement and its pull. But one thing I'll tell you for sure is the fact that there is a need for this. And it wasn't just me and Sophie who felt that.
So to really anchor us in this conversation, let's get to the foundation of what is an internal community and what does a healthy one look like to you?
So what is an internal community? They can take many different shapes and forms, I guess. So why would companies start community efforts in the first place? The most common examples or use cases we've seen so far are related to learning. Both Sophie and I are coming from an L&D background. So I guess communities are great social and peer learning playgrounds and spaces, especially when we think of communities of practice where you use that space and you come together, you bring together people in different levels of expertise. Some might be more advanced in their careers or they might just be joining. And they're all coming together for a certain purpose. Like they're either working in the same field, they have a similar role, for example, in this case, they're both first-time leaders or probably it's a community around executives, etc. And they're coming together to learn a set of skills that belongs to a set of practice. But there's many more different shapes and forms that community can take. We've seen communities around culture. We have seen communities build around transformation projects. We have seen community build around innovation, research and development, around specific functions to foster collaboration, for example, and break down silos. across, for example, engineering departments that are working in the same company, but they're working from different locations. And at some might overlap with projects, but others might not. How do we foster that collaboration and that best practice sharing amongst them? And we've also seen communities around topics of diversity, equity, and inclusion within companies, which usually come in the form of employee resources groups. So if I were to kind of pencil a general definition, are groups of people that are coming together around a shared something, a shared goal, a shared purpose, a shared need, and they are tapping into that collective brain and into the energy that they're creating together to support one another in that common goal that they have. And yeah, it's, again, I think also community, everything's a community at this moment, right? So my LinkedIn followers are a community. My newsletter subscribers are a community. I think we're overusing this term. So it's good to go back to its definition and actually go back to the fact that community are people that they have to connect with one another and they have to have clear lines of communication with one another that are not gated by something or someone. So those people, they have to be able to find each other, to find themselves, and to connect with one another without someone actually actively necessarily bringing them together. Sync, async, online, offline, it doesn't matter. But they have to be able to talk back and not only talk back to you as a community initiator, talk back with one another. And so when I put that definition, then it becomes very clear that a podcast audience is not a community because they can't really, they don't see each other. Or my LinkedIn followers are not a community because they have some exchange in the comments though. So is that a main community? I don't know. But yeah, that's where I stand.
I agree so much. I mean, I agree with everything you said. It's so nice to hear it amplified. The thing that I anchor people in when they're wanting to build communities or learn about communities is that it is an exchange. If there isn't inherently a way for them to contribute or connect, then they're just consuming content. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that serves a different purpose. And that's not a community. It could be an audience, it could be media, but it's a community is an exchange of connection, of information, of resources, of goals, of skills. You're so right. And I also love, again, speaking to your learning background, I love that you're showcasing that community, internal community especially, is not just the metaphorical pizza party at the company. I really liked Anna Maria's point that communities can't be gated by someone or something. There needs to be clear lines of communication between members for a community to flourish. We go on to discuss the need for people to meaningfully engage with their communities. There needs to be a reason to keep coming back. Sophie and Anna Maria are both passionate about protecting grassroots internal communities and not forcing communities where they aren't wanted. So again, love that you're bringing this learning component to it. Sophie, did you want to chime in? I want to leave some room for you to chime in with what an internal community is and what a healthy one looks like to you.
So I think, just like you, really agree with Anna Maria's vision and definition of this. And maybe one thing to add is that if you're listening to this and thinking, okay, do we have communities in our company? I think a lot of them are actually not called communities as well. So they are, yes, there will be some in any company, and they might be people who informally exchange on the site, but they meet up for lunch every month and they talk about their different project, or they talk because they have the same customer but in different industries. So there will be tons of groups that answer that definition and don't call themselves communities. And there's a range of words that they will use. Maybe sometimes just group, maybe sometimes network, collective, a cell, or anything. So it's important not to get too attached to the word community and really go back to that definition. And when we kind of talk about healthy ones, I think the first things that come to my mind is whether the space is like, you know, a safe space where people can be vulnerable. And so how that looks like is questions that are asked and questions that are answered, and discussions that happen where people don't necessarily have the same opinion, but, you know, the back and forth happens. So that's a good measure of this. And then another attribute as well, particularly because we're talking about internal communities, so always within a corporate frame, is an element of autonomy.
Something that jumped out at me that you said, first of all, I love that you brought this up, because you and I met recently and we talked about the balance between grassroots and curated communities and the differences. But something that you said that jumped out to me was the autonomy piece of that grassroots. If there are folks listening right now who are in positions of thinking about rewarding employees, increasing satisfaction at work, incentivizing employees, advocating for autonomy to be a part of or run those grassroots communities is a really great way to increase those metrics, or just to say it and simply just help people feel more connected at work and that they have a part in impacting how it feels to work there. Being able to run your own grassroots communities and have that autonomy. You and I have talked about how it really brings that special sauce, that magic ability to contribute at work. And for the people who have budget in mind, there's typically like low hard costs with that. You know, you're usually using existing tools, and as long as you're communicating about expectations about how much time it's going to, you know, take away from their other duties, it really allows that employee to feel a sense of ownership and something that really matters to them.
Yeah, I think definitely this element of making the culture one that allows you to start to contribute and participate in, you know, pretty much as many communities as you feel within the workplace is super important. And then the next step is also looking at how do you support? So allowing and then supporting, because actually whether it's creating or even contributing actively, these are two things that can be daunting, particularly yes. If it wasn't part naturally of your culture before this. And so after thinking about how to allow people and empower, it's also toolkits and things that are way more tactical about actually what skills are needed. How would you choose between all the different digital tools we've got in the company for that kind of community or this other one? So I think these two elements of culture and then going into the weeds of the tactical and making it easy, not just allowed, but actually easy, because you tell yes. resources about the how to do it.
Yeah, allowing is the first piece. Supporting is the second. I don't know if you all agree with this third piece, but maybe amplifying, you know, being able to share what these communities and our company are doing. Look at what they're doing. Look at what's going well. Look at how you can create this. Again, intrinsic reward, right? You know, there's low cost to that, but really big impact of we're not only allowing and supporting, but like we're co-signing that this is a good thing to do here if you're interested. Awesome. I'd love to hear what positions you're seeing inside companies that are working on internal community initiatives. You know, do you think it's formally part of someone's job? Is it volunteer? Any titles that come to mind?
It's everything. it's a mix. Yeah. I'm happy to see that it becomes more and more official, and there are more and more people that have this as a full-time job, Sophie being one of them. And she can tell more about what that transition looked like for her. From where I'm standing, there's a majority of, and maybe that's also because that's my network, so those are the people that I surround myself with or the networks that I'm part of. But because communities equal people, it kind of very naturally sometimes falls into the HR realm or learning and development departments or colleagues to start those if they're coming from the company side as a potential solution into a solution cocktail to a company challenge. And then suddenly we want to build a community. It's usually L&D or HR that is driving it, unless it's a transformation project and the communities, you're building a movement to support that transformation, which in that case, it might be, you know, a totally different department. But we also see it sitting in functions. And when I say functions, I mean in departments. Agile, for example, it's a place that feels very natural for communities, especially grassroots ones, to appear and be nurtured, because the way they work, what agile working means, is a lot of open communication and transparency and sharing and retrospective and learning and looking at ways of working and team coaching and all that. So that in itself, there are very a lot of behaviors and tools and mindsets in agile are very supportive or enriching or nurturing for communities.
I'm hearing it's very strategic.
I think that maybe linking it back to the conversation earlier, it doesn't matter if it comes from the company as a solution that it's put forward, or if it comes grassroots from a small group of employees and then it catches fire and then it starts spreading and so on. Eventually, those two areas will have to overlap, whether we want to or not, or whether we plan for that or not. Because if there's something that starts grassroots and it's really cool and people will see the value in it and it will start growing organically, like we shouldn't forget that we're still building something at work on the company's payroll. We're paid to do specific jobs. And if this kind of takes over and people are starting to spend more and more time in the community, someone eventually will come to ask, what is the space? What are you doing there? How often do you meet? What is happening? And what does the company stand to gain, right? Mm-hmm. And in that case, it's also this whole thing about stakeholders and sponsorship. And eventually, if it grows bigger, you would want to have the seal of approval of certain people in higher leadership levels, because eventually you will probably need some budget to set aside in order to move those efforts forward. And on the other side, I think in this case, if it starts from the company, like strategically, as you said, Katie, strategically HR, L&D, someone starts to build that community, they will have to move into the people side and the what's in it for members very early on. They cannot wait to build something, because that's basically impossible. It's basically impossible to build something without a community that is steered from someone without involving the members. We've seen that fall flat every single time. There's Slack groups that are empty and tumbleweeds are flying around, or Teams channels and whatnot. And the reality is, you've opened the space, you've opened the community, and you haven't asked anyone if they need that. So,
yes.
And going back to this kind of agency, or this kind of, do they have the freedom? Like, they have to feel members, in order for them to contribute, they have to feel that they have some sort of influence.
What a beautiful clarification around strategy, because sometimes the strategy, kind of to your point, is to allow it to grow on its own and the community to operate autonomously and evolve how it's needed to and wants to. And maybe the strategic skill here is the person who operates, you know, in, you know, HR or employee experience, is the one that pushes back and says, hey, leadership, I don't think that we should infiltrate this community for our business purposes. I think we should let it evolve on its own.
Yeah, I think there's always, it needs to be the right mix. And for different communities, it will look slightly different of strategy and passion. So there's a strategy, it's part of the strategic direction or the culture that of the company. But if it doesn't resonate with like the guts of the members, then it won't work. And just, I thought it might be interesting to look at the parenting tribe, for example, because this one was really started very from an emotional and passion point of view. So it was started by three of us who had gone through like the transition into parenthood and the juggle in linking this to career, etc. And we'd struggle all on our own, and then we got to a better point, and suddenly we talked about it, and we thought, when we were doing it, we were on our own. So probably a lot of other people are going through it on their own and then opening up later. So we thought, okay, we're going to start something. We'll see if anybody is interested, but we're going to start something so that people feel allowed to actually open up during and not just after once they've struggled through for months.
Yes. Yes.
So it really started from something that really resonated with people, with like emotions and challenges and passion. But then I wanted to just show up a few examples of how things became more strategic. And it was a natural progression that was really nurtured by, in this case, our diversity, equity and inclusion team. So when it got created, I think in like 6 or 7 months, we reached 400 or 500 members. So it became big enough that they just heard about it. Then they got in touch. They checked, okay, what kind of technical support do you need? Here is where all of the ERGs are putting their events. There's a calendar. So we're going to give you the access so you can put events in there. And then it was very much of a like a support discussion. Oh, if you'd like, we could look into executive sponsorship. At that time, we felt like it wasn't actually something that we needed for the goals that with the members, with defined for ourselves. So we even had the space to say, no, actually not now. We're really like more on a peer-to-peer network and support. But then we started creating resources for people leaders to help people in their team going through a list of potential challenges and transition linked to parenthood and working parents. So we partnered with HR to pilot it and deploy it in countries. So it became like a real partnership with a structured function.
I just want to add something there because I think in all the examples that you gave, Sophie, this is brilliant, but just dawned on me, like you never left the driver's seat. Like you never left the steering wheel of that space, right? So everything that came, you reached out and you got the support and you got this, you were amplified and you were pushed and you were helped, et cetera. But at no given time has someone from HR or diversity inclusion came to say, okay, now we are going to start doing something in this space. And this is an initiative from HR and so on. And I think that is with grassroots communities, that is the biggest challenge that, and quite frankly, I sometimes tell community, you need to protect your community. Like it will come a moment where you will have to protect that space from other external internal forces, because the business will want to come and potentially use it for pushing different agendas or rolling out different projects. And then it's up to us to say, this is not the space for that. That's not why we created this space. So I think that's a great example on how it can become strategic. And interestingly enough, how wonderful it is. And I know that we're now talking like there's so many layoffs out there and all the budgets are cut and et cetera. How beautiful it is when you're allowing your employees to find the cause that they care about and come together and put in from their time, their effort, their energy, their creativity, their talent, et cetera, to build up useful stuff for the company. Because otherwise, who would have created those artifacts and those materials?
This reminds me of a metaphor that I heard someone use around communities and the role of, you know, Anna Maria, what you just highlighted about what Sophie said about being that protector and that kind of the one who identifies where the boundaries are and like finds a way to communicate them. It's almost a similar dynamic of like a coach and their team, right? There are spectators who see what the community is doing and are probably like, very on board. Like, we love this community. We love our soccer team. We love our football team, but we have all these opinions. We think that this season, the direction should go this way. And it's the leader of this community, whether it's grassroots or a curated community, it's Sophie's job in that scenario to take that input and know that it's input and have the vision and the intentionality and the feedback rhythms with the community and the external stakeholders to distill it down to okay, what is our vision or our purpose in this community? And does all this input or direction or whatnot fit with it? And it's my job as Sophie, as the protector of this community, to communicate what doesn't fit. Because ultimately, like, my job as the guide or the protector or the moderator of this community is to protect the ecosystem here so we can continue to thrive and evolve and continue on our shared purpose. I'd love it for us to talk more about this if there are other examples of community building initiatives that have gone really well.
Yes. I'm going to pick one that is internal for the purpose of the conversation today. And it's the very small community of practice that I launched as, and it was attached to a internal train the trainer project that was attached to the onboarding process back when I was at Ace and Tate. So a bit of a context. We're talking about a retail industry eyewear. So we are selling a specific, you could almost say, medical product inside our stores, over 60 stores across 10 European countries. And in retail, the challenge of the industry is that you have a high rotation of employees. Everyone's really young. Majority of them are at their first job. And so you have a high fluctuation of employees that you constantly have to onboard, especially for us. We were selling a piece of equipment that goes on your face, and it impacts your life if we mess it up, right? So you can literally not see, or it might damage your eyes. So the onboarding was a very important piece, and it had obviously an educational component to it, and content component to it, and opticians, and like the whole thing was done very purposefully and very intentionally. But then we thought, who's going to deliver this? Like it had an e-learning component to it. But when you talk about sales, and when you talk about interacting with clients, and when you talk about easing them up in the choices that they have to make, where they pick a piece of object that goes on and sits on their face every day, you really need to ensure that those skills are there. And we're building those skills, especially for young people that might find themselves in the first job. So as an attachment to that project, and this is, by the way, a very common, I guess, example of how L&D might choose to start communities. They might attach that to a longer project, whether that's an onboarding or that's a leadership project, etc., internally to a certain population. And our goal was to build a trainer, to train a trainer in each one of our stores with the sole purpose of them one-on-one onboarding every new colleague that they had. And also, besides onboarding, they were the ones responsible for product refresh and monthly training sessions with the whole team. Once a month, they will actually run a workshop and a small training and prepare materials and sticky notes and flip charts and activities and all sorts of things. So it was a proper training that was run in store by people that weren't working in L&D. So it was almost like an army of trainers. Now, we rolled that out with a train the trainer, etc. And my idea was, well, these people are going to, they've probably never done this before. They've never trained. This is the first time doing that. They haven't been leaders. And as a trainer, you do have to act in a, you do have to practice or make use of leadership skills and kind of grow inside that role. So we were working with an intranet that was a centralized place for all of the store systems. So it didn't matter if it was learning, operations, everything they had to do, it came into one spot, and it was allowing us to create these communities, that platform. So they all had their trainer logins, and they were all invited in this special place inside that platform, which was only designed for them. It had a chat, blog, we will spotlight trainers. They will always share their pictures, their designs, their PDFs, their activities that they were hosting. And we will also have monthly workshops with them that I was designing and hosting on different soft skills and peer support and peer coaching. And it was amazing because besides the fact that they loved it and I was loving it, and I could clearly see that it was working by the level of engagement, the fact that people were writing me things, they were coming up with ideas, they were sharing, they were exchanging, they were having a blast. And this, to go back into the impact that communities might have.
So We always ask every guest on our show a really hardball question. What's the best mistake you've made and why?
Yeah, I had a reaction when I realized that that was one of the classic questions. I was like, oh no, it's almost like the question of where do you see yourself in 5 years? You know, like one of the big questions that are scary. But because of the topic today, I was thinking of one that is really linked to internal community building. And basically, as I came back from one of my maternity leaves, which at the time I was based in the UK, so that quite a long period of time, a year. And so when you come back, it's really like you're coming back to a new company and a new position, because in a year in my company, everything always changes. So there was, I ended up being in a position that wasn't right for me. And I think my mistake, to answer the question, was that I didn't voice that feeling of it's not right, I don't want to go back to that space. And I just thought, I'll just see how it goes when I actually go back into work. And as I predicted, it didn't go well. It wasn't the right fit or anything. And then I still said nothing and kind of went through it and sorted it out in other ways and transitioned into a new role, and only then kind of opened up about it, and then found out that it happened to a lot of people. And so I think that was a great mistake, because everything turns out fine. I'm in a job that I love. Okay. And also it actually then helped me create something better with the example of the parenting tribe. But it's, I think, quite a useful mistake when you think about internal community building, because with the number of people in your company, if there's anything that you're feeling is not right, but also if there's anything you are excited about, chances are that other people in the company are feeling the same. And that means that just being courageous enough to open up means that you will find these other people, and that you can get together and you can problem solve together. Or if it's for something exciting, just take it forward together. And actually, just by having this community builder reflexes and ways of doing things and of connecting with people, you end up solving your own issues or amplifying your excitement about something, as well as creating something for others. So that's the one I was thinking about.
And the extra piece that is hard to measure, you help other people feel like they belong.
Yeah.
There's so definitely much that we talk about with belonging in this work. And, you know, it's not the high dollar business value measurement, but it's a really important one. Yeah. And that's what I heard inside your example too, Sophie.
Yeah. And it's something like the other, one of our learning communities is the leadership community for people leaders. And one of the members described it this way when she got invited to welcome some of the new members and talk about her own experience. And she defined the space as, it's where you find your people. And now we literally use it as one of the taglines of the community, is like, find your people. And then another member described it as taking a moment for myself. So that's literally now our two taglines for this learning community, is like, take a moment for yourself and find your people. That's
what a win.
It really describes that feeling of belonging. Perfect.
What's your best mistake, Anna Maria?
So I've talked about this mistake quite a few times. If you would ask me what's the most embarrassing thing, I would have plenty of examples. But if you ask what is the mistake, I think it's very hard for me to remember them as mistakes in a way, because I always I don't see mistakes as mistakes if I'm learning something from them, basically, which is the point of making them. So I've talked about this mistake, and I may in other podcasts and conversations. I want to surface it because I think it happens to a lot of people. And it's very common when you're transitioning from a mindset. It's the context of community building. When we are transitioning from a mindset where we design something for people and we hold the truth and we hold the control and we know best than everyone else and we have all the answers and we're just creating and putting things out there, and community doesn't work like that. We've been talking a lot about today about this, you know, giving folks the opportunity to contribute and make it their own and have agency and all that. And I knew the theory to that as I was getting into community. It's like, okay, I want to build this with people. So I think that somehow, theoretically, I knew what that was supposed to look like. But then when I ended up doing that, when the time came to do that in theory, it was very hard for me to do this, letting control and kind of giving people the freedom to make that space their own. That was a hard thing for me to do. I wasn't used to that. I was coming from the typical manager. You have to make sure that everything you put out there, it's perfect. Perfect according to who? Perfect according to my view of the world, right? Because that's the only perfect that I know. And the mistake was to actually, in Alani Shakers, we have a core team and everyone has a different role in that core team. And a role means you're in charge of creating something and putting something out there and sustaining it over time. In this case, it was the book club. And we just had a transition in the book club and we had someone who take over the book club, and we brainstorm with certain ideas on how we can elevate the project. And they said, okay, leave it with me, Anna Maria. I will do that. And they started working on that. And I had access to the same Notion page. And one day I went and I was like, oh, I can do this better. And I went and I changed things inside the Notion page. And then I went in Slack and say, hey, I saw your work. It was great. I just made some changes according to my view. And obviously, not surprising, I'm forever grateful to that person for coming back to me and calling me out. And they said, you told me this is mine. And now you're making it yours. Do you want to do this? Or do you want me to do this? And I said, I want you to do this. That's not what you're transmitting here. And he said, I have a different vision of it. And I get that you have a different vision, but you also have to trust me. And then the inflection point or the lessons that I learned there was, it's not about, I think it's good to share feedback, because it's good to have that type of, you know, the battle of arguments, or, you know, we're bringing in order to elevate something we're working on as a community. I'm not saying, oh no, I'm not going to give someone feedback if I see something that might be improved. It's not about that. But I started to learn to make the difference on what are the things that matter, what's the essence, and what are the things that are not impacting the usefulness of the thing that we're creating.
Yeah, like, is my feedback making their vision better, or is it inserting my vision?
Yeah, but also even like, does anyone care if this is a header one or header three? No. Does anyone care whether this is pink and you wanted it blue? No one cares, right? So all of those things where I'm like, well, it doesn't matter if we put my version or your version out, it still serves the purpose of what this thing is supposed to be doing. So if it does that, then it's potato, potato, right? It doesn't matter. Whereas if I believe that I hold a piece of a puzzle that might elevate this design, that might elevate this thing, I will happily share it with you with the right arguments and let you decide. I mean, if my arguments are strong enough, then, you know, it will get in there or not, because you have a better argument and so on. So we start that kind of, you know, the conversation around that without. So folks, do not go behind people's backs and change their stuff.
Even with the best intentions.
Even with the best intent, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
I loved this. I'm so glad we got you on the show.
Yay.
Thank you both so much. I can't wait for this to be, this is our third and final episode of the mini season. And so this is a beautiful episode to round things out and end on. So I'm so, so grateful for your time. I think that this conversation is maybe a newer topic to some of our audience. So really, really grateful for you sharing your expertise and your ideas here. What a great conversation to cap off this mini-series. If you missed the other episodes, make sure to check them out. Here are my main takeaways from this episode. Internal communities take many shapes. Communities can form around shared interests, innovation, cultural connections, and so much more. Communities need to be built around more than just working together for them to last. And if you're seeing grassroots communities form in their workplace, these next two takeaways are extra important. Use a mix of tools to empower communities. Knowing which community tools to use can feel daunting. Employing a mix of methods and asking employees what they want, it's a good path forward, don't build a community without members. Building a community and forcing people into it almost never works. Uncover if there is a need for community before you open it. And if you do, work closely with those early members to build it. Thank you so much for tuning into this mini series of New World of Work. Here at Oyster, we believe distributed and remote workforces are the future of work, and we are helping to create a future where organizations around the world are empowered to leverage global talent to grow to their full potential. Thanks for listening to New World of Work, the podcast exploring the new frontier of the modern workforce through an international lens. We hope this episode served to expand your horizons and open your mind to a new perspective. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show if you enjoyed this episode. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we'd love if you'd leave a review. I'm your host, Katie McCauley. See you next time.